We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies, as free and independent states, have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. The Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, has come up in nearly every episode to date. And the key takeaway from this war is that France lost all of its North American possessions, including New France or Canada. You might also remember from our episodes on Canada that French Canadians chose not to align themselves with the Patriots during the Revolutionary War. And this is surprising considering the fact that French Canadians, and indeed France, had been at war with the British for decades. So while New France, now Canada, supported the British during the War for Independence, Old France had other things on its mind, namely revenge. France was furious with the outcome of the Seven Years' War, and many centuries of rivalry with Britain meant that anything the French could do to weaken the British merited some devious attention. The American Rebellion provided a perfect opportunity to undermine the British Empire. So as early as June of 1775, when the Continental Army was established, the French secretly shipped arms and munitions to General Washington's army. This covert assistance continued for many years until it became a formal and open alliance. Indeed, on the 6th of February, 1778, France officially recognized the United States, and 1 month later, Britain declared war on France as retaliation. The American War of Independence had officially become a great power conflict and a global war. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves. Our theme today is France and the Declaration of Independence. Why did France choose to help the colonies in their fight against Great Britain? How was the Declaration of Independence received in France in 1776? How important was French assistance in winning the War of Independence? And what assistance did they provide? And lastly, what role, if any, did the American Declaration have on the French Revolution in 1789? And here with me today to answer these questions is François Forstenberg. Welcome, François.
Thank you for having me.
François is professor of history at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. His research explores the history of the United States and the Atlantic world in the 18th and 19th centuries. His first book, In the Name of the Father, Washington's Legacy, Slavery, and the Making of a Nation, examined how images of George Washington in 19th century print culture helped promote American nationalism. And his second book, When the United States Spoke French, Five Refugees Who Shaped a Nation, connects the United States to the French Atlantic world in the 18th century Age of Revolutions. So links are in the show notes. François, you chose that wonderful passage towards the end of the Declaration to read, where the founders declare themselves fully independent states with the power to do things like contract alliances, which indeed they did by contracting an alliance with France. Why do you think it's important we focus on that passage particularly as we begin our discussion of France and the Declaration today?
Well, I think there are two reasons that I might highlight in that passage that are particularly significant for the revolution and for the country. One is that the Declaration of Independence means that these are actually separate states. This is not a rebellion. This is not simply a sort of colonial civil war. This is an attempt to establish a new state that will have the power to make alliances the way that states are able to. And I think many people understood right from the beginning that the United States would have a very hard time winning the American Revolution militarily without support abroad. And the most obvious place to turn to for support was France, the traditional enemy of Great Britain and a great power. The second reason that I would highlight in the second aspect of that passage that I would highlight is about the ability to contract alliances, establish commerce. So it's not simply a political and military alliance that the United States is going to try to establish with France and with other countries around the world. These are commercial alliances. And here we see the economic implications of the American Revolution, which is that the United States will no longer be a set of colonies understood in a kind of mercantilist sense, whose purpose is to benefit the mother country with extreme trade restrictions imposed, which are, you know, one of the causes of the revolution itself, of the rebellion itself. But they're going to be able to now act as states and establish trading relationships with other countries and with other colonies, very importantly. So I think these are two really important aspects of this passage.
There's a lot there I want to follow up on. The first idea that occurred to me, because I hadn't really thought of it before, was that economic or mercantilist idea. At this time, when France is trying to determine whether or not they should formally recognize the United States, and then obviously that would lead to war again with Great Britain, I've always understood France as just wanting to do anything to undermine British interests. I never thought about the fact that maybe there was an economic angle, that there was something that the colonies was producing, maybe, or there was some sort of important trade relationship that they could have. Was there something that the French coveted in the 13 colonies that they weren't getting access to?
Yes, so this is a really interesting, for me, and I think important element of what will emerge as the Franco-American alliance. I mean, one thing to say is that when we talk about France, there is no sort of unified French view or French politics. There are all kinds of constituencies within France. And one of the more important and influential ones, which is emerging in the middle of the 18th century, in the wake of a lot of new philosophical and political thinking and economic thinking, is what people call the physiocrats, the physiocracy. These are people who are interested in liberalizing the economic system in France and between France and its colonies. So they're less committed to, in fact, these figures are challenging the traditional economic relationship between France and its colonies and between France and other countries. They're what we would call liberals, economic liberals. They're advocating a system of freer trade. So that's one thing. And those are the people who are going to be very supportive of the American Revolution in ways that will make the crown quite anxious. The French ministers quite anxious, many of them. Some of the French ministers, though, are physiocrats themselves or influenced by physiocratic thought. So that's one element. And the second is that France, you know, for the people who are making the decisions to ally with France, and as I'm sure we'll talk about, it takes a while for France to sign on to this colonial rebellion. They want to be sure that the United States are indeed
a viable
independent
ally.
States. A viable ally as an independent state. They don't want to support the losing side here. So it will take a few years, but there are many interests for those who supported the French. It's a big risk for the French officials to support the colonial rebellion for a whole variety of reasons. This is very risky. And one of the risks is that they would lose another war. One of the risks is that they would win and unleash powerful centrifugal forces that would disrupt the imperial system itself, which is something that is economically hugely beneficial to France. But I think one important objective, and it goes back to the Seven Years' War, is very strategic. One of the things that imperial thinkers and, you know, the catastrophic defeat by France in the Seven Years' War unleashes a whole set of attempts at reform and of questions of what went wrong here. What did France do wrong to be able to lose so decisively to British power? This is a real, as you said, a real humiliation for France. So one of the reflections is that Britain benefited tremendously from the mainland colonies in North America. So the Caribbean colonies in the 18th century are of tremendous economic importance to European nations. They're generating enormous amounts of wealth on the backs of enslaved labor, producing sugar and indigo and coffee and cotton and all the commodities that are powering the European economy at this point. The importance of the Caribbean is really central. And France lost naval warfare over and over again, and they were defeated. Their navy was really defeated in the Seven Years' War. And one of the things that they learned from that experience is that the mainland colonies were important sources of strength for Britain. So the mainland colonies could supply British colonies with food, with lumber, with all kinds of natural resources to power this economic system in the colonies. The British mainland colonies also provided local bases, naval bases, to reinforce the British Navy It provided manpower. Many colonists, British colonists, enlisted in the war and supported the British Navy. So with these harbors, with all this support, I mean, this is one of the reasons that Britain was able to defeat France so decisively in the Caribbean. So France began to look at these mainland colonies, if they could detach them from Britain, this wouldn't just undermine the British Empire, although it certainly would. And this wouldn't just be a matter of revenge for France against Britain, although it certainly was. But this would become now a source of great strength for France in supplying its colonies with lumber and provisions and bases to repair its ships in the case of war and all kinds of other things. And these elements are all actually in the Treaty of Alliance that France and the United States establish. It's a Treaty of Alliance and Commerce.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Early in your response there, you had mentioned, though, that because I kind of understand the strategic perspective here, however you want to put your focus, strategically separating the colonies from Britain makes sense. Economically, it opens up all these markets. But you just kind of said this fascinating thing that you passed over quickly, which is that there is a group of thinkers in France who thought that actually winning would be a problem for France. So if the colonies did win and become independent, it could be problematic for France. Can you just sort of outline that thought process? Because I'm not sure I get it.
Those aren't the physiocrats who take this position. This would be more of the, you know, ministerial position, the crown ministers. But Europe at this point has established itself over the previous centuries. These European powers have established a great deal of power, you know, political power, military power, economic power from their colonies, from the empire. So it's a very risky move here to support a colonial rebellion, to support colonies that are going to, you know, separate, because what is the precedent here? What precedent are they establishing? And indeed, the Spanish crown is very hesitant to support the American Revolution, which they eventually do, bowing to French pressure. But they see very clearly that this is a very dangerous precedent to set. And a successful colonial rebellion that establishes new nations in the new world will be a catastrophic or risk catastrophic damage, economic, political, and military damage to European powers. So I think from that perspective, this is a very dangerous operation. You know, this is a very dangerous thing to support, as it could undermine their strength.
And so there is a long-term strategic theoretical doctrine in France that really is looking long-term and potentially predicting the revolutions in Latin America against Spain or the revolution in Saint-Domingue, and saying, you know, we don't ever want this precedent to be set. As much as we love to undermine the British, let's not help create a crack in this more wide European colonial project.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we don't want to risk damage to ourselves as we undermine the British, as you sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face or something like that. That's very risky. But, you know, I mean, I think what we're getting at here is that there are fundamentally, you know, two visions of national power and of the relationship between empires and national power and national strength. And there's a view that says the source of national power is more autarkic, right? It should be, and this would be in the 18th century, this would be the more mercantilist view, that the colonies should benefit the mother country only. And then there are others who say, no, the source of national power and economic power is through a system of trade alliances and trade relationships. And there are people who believe that today, of course, and that that will actually benefit the mother country. And this is the emerging vision that I was talking about earlier, the sort of physiocratic vision. So for those people, they would see an anti-colonial rebellion that would result in the establishment of a free state that could engage in a trading relationship with France as beneficial. Now, if you're, let's say, a merchant in France who benefits from exclusive access to Caribbean trade with your French colonies, you may disagree. You may not want to see competition like that. So there are all kinds of economic and ideological interests at stake here that are clashing with each other in this debate.
Yeah, I think my takeaway from this part of our conversation is that just as there were wildly diverse interests on the American patriot side, on the British imperial side, we also have to recognize that French interests and ways of thinking about colonies in general and the American colonies specifically are wildly diverse. And you can't just say this is the French position. Obviously, there's eventually a formal French position, but before the official decision is made, there are lots of competing interests trying to, you know, find a suitable way forward as events are erupting in the American Revolution. Okay, so you mentioned the Seven Years' War. Many of the founding fathers, certainly George Washington, fought in the Seven Years' War against France. As we go from 1763 to 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, you know, a lot's happening. To quickly summarize, colonists are taking a lot of credit for the victory over the French. The British Army is saying, no, the colonists really didn't help. The Continental militias were pretty weak. We did all the work. That's certainly one element of what's going on. Of course, King George then is doing stuff like the Stamp Acts to pay for the war, Townshend Acts, and other things to pay for the 10,000 British regulars who are stationed in the colonies. And of course, in other episodes, we've talked a lot about all of these decisions that lead to the war. But I just want to look at all of that lead up from 1763 to 1775 or 1776, how colonists are looking at France and French relations, and mostly how this trajectory is going, where they're starting to think about France from being an enemy, a defeated enemy in 1763, to then obviously something tips, and now they're starting to look at France as potentially a friend in war, which is a huge flip-flop.
It's a huge flip-flop, because the British colonists had been at war with French colonists for a century. This has been ongoing. And a great deal of the British culture that had, the British political culture that had emerged over the 18th century was founded in a vicious anti-Catholicism, sense of Catholicism as popery, as something profoundly dangerous. This was central to the ideology of the British Empire, and in general, anti-French sentiment. So this was a late turn. And even as the American colonists, now the Americans, begin embracing France and trying to woo France to support the rebellion, there's still a good deal of ambivalence and kind of latent anti-Catholicism there. The Seven Years' War, as you've talked about it at length with your other guests, is, I think, an interesting case of be careful what you wish for. That is to say, the British victory creates tremendous challenges for the British state after the war. And their victory was, in a sense, much, much too great for their own ability to handle. The British Empire had suddenly become, which had traditionally been a maritime empire, which had traditionally based on its naval strength, had suddenly become territorial. They had huge gains, not just in North America. They had secured these new colonies in the Caribbean, taken formerly French colonies in the Caribbean. They had briefly held Cuba, and they also had huge gains in India, which caused all kinds of dangers for the British Empire. So managing this new and expanded empire created all kinds of challenges for British officials. And how would they try to assimilate is probably the wrong word, but how would they try to incorporate these new French subjects in what had been New France, what is now being called Canada or Quebec? Their traditional allies, their traditional Native American allies, also are angered at the loss of the French colonies, which puts them in a very precarious state. They no longer have the ability to kind of balance French and British empires against each other. You know, and it puts the interests of the British settlers, these traditional British, the core of the British Empire in North America, these British settlers, completely at odds with indigenous allies, because the British settlers want more land and the indigenous allies want to maintain their land. So it's going to create all kinds of challenges of governance for the British Empire. There's a great line. It's possible that this is apocryphal, but it's much quoted. And it's by Choiseul, who was the foreign minister during the Seven Years' War. And he was the one who was engaged in negotiations with Pitt, who had become the prime minister in Britain and who had led the dramatic British victory. And he tells an associate at one point, I'll read it in French, but then we can, you know, translate it in English. He says, Je m'étonne que votre grand Pitt attache tant d'importance à l'acquisition du Canada, territoire trop peu peuplé pour devenir jamais dangereux pour vous, et qui, entre nos mains, servirait à garder vos colonies dans une dépendance dont elles ne manqueront pas de s'affranchir le jour où le Canada sera cédé. What that says is, I'm amazed that your great Pitt attached so much importance at the acquisition of Canada, a territory that was much too sparsely settled to ever become a danger to you, and which under our hands serve to keep your colonies in a state of dependence, which they won't miss the opportunity to emancipate themselves from one day once Canada will be seated. What he's saying here is that Pitt shouldn't have taken New France. He should have left it in French hands, because the threat, this threat against the British colonies, against the settlers, kept the settlers allied to British power. As soon as that was no longer a threat, as soon as New France was no longer French, was held in British hands, there was no reason for the American settlers to rely on British power anymore. They had lost the reason for maintaining themselves in a state of dependence. And the reason I think that that's such an interesting and powerful quote, whether or not it was actually said by Choiseul, is it gets at a fundamental issue, which is that this rebalance of power in North America, the consolidation of British power in North America, means that the settlers are much more apt now to rebel and to liberate themselves from British power.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because it also confirms why many of the British Sugar Islands chose to remain part of the British Empire. And it wasn't necessarily because of threat from the French or the Spanish. It's because having British troops and the Royal Navy protecting your Sugar Island, maintaining that connection to the British Empire, was out of fear of slave uprisings like Tacky's revolt in Jamaica. So definitely the strength of the Royal Navy and the British Army was a good reason to basically maintain a very strong friendship with London. Yeah, I get it. So if everyone claims this, just a short comment, if everyone claims that the French minister said this, like, what's your theory why no one can find the source of the quotation?
If I remember properly, it goes back to a biography of Jefferson that I think was written in French, maybe, and then it was quoted by Bancroft. It may be that document exists somewhere. But even then, it would be a secondhand report.
It confirms what I was saying earlier, that there was kind of a long-term strategic assessment that the general European colonial system profited the old European powers, even if they were fighting amongst themselves in other ways. It was better that they had the colonies, all colonies, dependent back on the motherland, be it French colonies with France or British colonies with Britain or Spanish colonies with Spain. And that, like, ideological system or political system benefited everyone together more, even if they were constantly at war. It's funny.
I don't think it benefited everyone. It benefited certain interests at the expense of others, right? So one of the, you know, really important tensions that is challenging this system of empire is the interests of the settlers themselves. These colonial merchants, as we know, resented not being able to trade, at least legally, with the French colonies and the Dutch colonies and so on. And this became a source of incredible friction with the British Empire once it began to try to enforce those codes. French planters in Saint-Domingue resent having to ship all their goods to French merchants. That's a problem for them. And this creates powerful centrifugal forces for the Haitian Revolution, ultimately. So you know, there's always these tensions within, you know, certain French merchants benefit from the monopoly, and their interests are at risk in a more free trade system. But the French settlers, the French planters and others, are, you know, their interests are different. So you have these tensions, which can be kept held in check when you have the military threat from another power, for example. But once you lose that military threat, they're hard to keep in check.
Okay. I want to go back to this trajectory that's changing someone like Jefferson or Washington from being anti-French during the Seven Years' War to suddenly begging for French support in a war against Britain, their old colonial mother. So this is a period of 15 years. Are there specific events that make someone like Washington or Jefferson or Adams start thinking, oh, we better start courting the French? Is it just a general shift in attitude? I mean, how would you describe how that's happening? Or is it just merely self-interest? It's like, listen, guys, we're going to declare independence. We need a big, strong ally.
Yeah, I think it's the last. You know, I don't read this, and you may find others who disagree with me, but I don't read this as a gradual shift at all. I read it as a very abrupt shift and a very late shift, which really only happens once the military fighting begins. And there's a kind of strategic assessment that we need French support, and ideally we could get support from Quebec, which is automatically admitted as a state, by the way. I don't know if this has come up in your conversations
before. Yeah, it has. It was the only colony that was automatically admitted if they chose to. Yeah,
exactly. They had pre-admission as a 14th state. So that was the vision. But for me, this is a very abrupt change. The Quebec Act is one of the sources of great anger among the colonists. And one of the reasons they're angry, there's a variety of reasons that they're angry about the Quebec Act. But one of the reasons that, and the Quebec Act, which was passed in 1774, becomes known as one of the, it's joined with the Coercive Acts as one of the sort of intolerable acts, although it's quite separate. It has a completely separate origins from, you know, for example, the closing of the Massachusetts port and some of these other measures that were meant to crack down on the colonies. But because it coincides in time, it becomes a source of great anger and frustration among British colonists, particularly in New England. And one of the things that they're very angry about is that these Catholic subjects will be given political rights. And this results in an upsurge of anti-Catholic sentiment and expressions of anti-Catholicism, very traditional political sentiment within British political culture. And so there's a great deal of anger, and that's in 1774. And then a year later, they're marching in to say, will you ally with us? So there's a very, in my mind, very abrupt change in this. And, you know, it's no surprise if you are Canadian and you're paying any attention to what people are saying in New England and in other colonies about you, about the Catholics. And you have this, you know, tradition of, you know, centuries long, generations long conflict with these settlers. It's no surprise that you're going to be a little suspicious of their intentions to ally with you.
Yeah, I always think it's funny that the letters to Canada by Congress, some were entitled to the oppressed people of Canada. And that's, I always think, a classic American thing to tell people in other countries that they're not free and therefore we're going to invade or something. And, you know, people have different notions of what political freedom means is the larger non-joking point.
That's absolutely right. And if you're a Canadian, I mean, that is to say, if you're, you know, someone of French descent in the St. Lawrence Valley, because this was the focus. Now, Canada, as we'll talk about, stretches far beyond the St. Lawrence Valley, but you could have a very cold-blooded assessment of where are my interests better protected? Is it within a British crown that has just given me political rights, or is it with these settlers who are engaged in a colonial rebellion and are viciously anti-Catholic? And I think there's every reason to think, you know, the British Empire is a better bet for us.
Yeah, good point. I want to read that entire grievance about the Quebec Act, and then I have a specific question just to remind the audience. So this is the grievance in the declaration that references Quebec, the neighboring province. So he has abolished the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. So there's a lot going on there. One, there's this fear that King George has done this Quebec Act. And this is kind of not a Trojan horse, but as a precedent that he can start making unilateral decisions in the other British colonies. And you can respond to that, but I first wanted just to ask you a broader question about these words that we see throughout the Declaration of Independence: absolute rule, tyranny, despotism, etc. To what extent is a French king guilty of all of the behaviors that the colonies are complaining about King George? I mean, they're constantly going through and complaining about the king and his you know, royal prerogatives. He has dissolved representatives repeatedly. He has obstructed the administration of justice. He has made judges dependent on his will alone. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power. This all sounds like stuff that a French king would do too. So again, why are we allying ourselves with this despotic tyrant, the King of France, when we're trying to get rid of our own despotic tyrant, the King of Britain?
These are very strange bedfellows, aren't they? As you're pointing out, I mean, the French monarchy is a much more absolutist monarchy than anything that the British monarchists could have dreamed of. And these Republicans who are proclaiming these anti-monarchical principles are seeking to ally themselves with the most powerful and absolutist and, let's call it, despotic, if you want, monarchy in Europe. So that is a profound paradox. And it's, I think this is a question of interests relative to ideology. But the paradox runs in both directions, as we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, because, why is the most absolutist monarch in Europe? Why is he even considering allying with these Republicans who are proclaiming these anti-monarchical principles? Isn't this very dangerous for the king too? So strange bedfellows, but they both have interests in the successful outcome of this rebellion.
Okay, good. And now we can go back to the Quebec Act passage there, that grievance. How is it exactly that the colonists thought that the arbitrary government and that absolute rule that King George had, in some ways, King George had, as you said, freed the French Catholics to be more French and Catholic with the Quebec Act. I guess I don't understand why they thought this was such a threat.
Well, it established a government without elected assemblies, which is one of the major issues at stake here. What are the power of colonial assemblies versus royal governors? And in Quebec, you have a very powerful royal governor, Guy Carleton, who doesn't have to fight with a local assembly. So, they're called new subjects, have different interests from the more traditional subjects, the British subjects. And there is a small British merchant class in Quebec, which is very angered by the Quebec Act, in a system in which you can only vote if you're a Protestant landholder. You have a good deal of political power in this system. But if rights are now granted to Catholics, if political rights are granted to Catholics, that, your interests are diluted. And by the way, the Quebec Act grants political rights to Catholics in New France, 75 years before they're going to be granted to Catholics in Ireland. So it does something really meaningful. It's one of the earliest grants of political rights to Catholic subjects within the British Empire. And that, too, is done for strategic interests in large part. How are we going to maintain the alliance, in the context of a colonial rebellion where these colonies just to the south are in a state of growing insurrection? How are we going to maintain the alliance of the French subjects in New France? And it's a good bet, actually, for the British Empire. One, I think, very important aspect, though, about the Quebec Act, which doesn't, I think, get enough attention in the scholarly literature, because the sort of anti-Catholic nature of this is well known. And also the concern about assemblies, which are going to, the role of assemblies and the danger of just absolutist rule, as they call it, despotic rule by the crown, is one important element. But another, a really important element for the British settlers is that it changes the geography of Quebec. I mean, the province of Quebec isn't just the St. Lawrence Valley, according to the Quebec Act. It extends into the Great Lakes and it extends down into the Ohio Valley. So all of a sudden, this land, which is very valuable, the colonists have been eyeing this land for decades, and there are all kinds of colonial land companies, including some in which Washington, George Washington, has a stake, and they think that they should own this land in the Ohio Valley. But all of a sudden, it's been transferred into the jurisdiction of Quebec, which means these land titles will be granted not in some provincial assembly or provincial by a provincial government, but by the colonial governor in Quebec. And so there's a set of major economic interests at stake here for the British settlers who are eyeing this Indian land in the West.
And Franklin, too, I think, had some money invested in expanding West and others, indeed, too.
But almost everybody who's a major political figure.
Anyone who is anyone, it's like crypto coin today. you had to have some land claims in the Ohio Valley. Let's go back to France now. So 1774, we talked about the Quebec Act. We're getting very, very close to the outbreak of war, and then in 1775, and then the Declaration of Independence in 1776. So let's just start with then 1775, around Lexington and Concord. France presumably has lots of spies in the colonies. Word is getting back to the various French ministries that things aren't looking good for Imperial Britain and the colonies. Colonists are getting more and more angry. How is France sort of preparing the imperial ministers and thinkers about what's coming? Are they really at this point like, absolutely there's going to be a full-blown revolution? Just describe what's going on in the corridors of power in Paris.
Well, one of the major efforts after the French defeat in the Seven Years' War was to rebuild the French Navy. And, there was a very clear-eyed assessment that the French Navy had failed and that the British Navy had really dominated here. So I think for French imperial officials, military officials, there is, I think, a sense that a new war will, with Great Britain will be inevitable. We just don't know when or why, you know, what will be the sort of cause of an outbreak. And I think French officials want to, you know, have some confidence that when war does break out, they've got a better chance at victory than they did in the past. So they want their navy rebuilt. I don't think that anybody, well, I mean, we talked about how Choiseul, this far-seeing minister, had possibly predicted this outcome. So I think, you know, there was a sense that the British Empire may have been overstretched at this point, and this will create opportunities for France. But I'm not sure anybody predicted, you know, this particular outcome, at least not now. But it fell in their lap. I mean, here is basically a great deal of dissension and, you know, the beginnings, the stirrings of a colonial rebellion, which could powerfully undermine the British Empire, and if handled well by France, could turn into a major asset for French power. So I think they begin paying attention to what's happening in the colonies. And I think most people would bet, I mean, anybody would have, I would have bet too, that this is not going to be a successful rebellion. The asymmetry of power is just too great. And some, you know, resentment or popular anger can be either waited out or simply squashed militarily.
But they got their feet wet real early. I mean, they were ready with arms shipments within weeks of war breaking out.
Yes,
by June. So within 8 weeks, they're already getting their feet wet.
Well, that's right. And there's every reason to support this as a kind of, let's call it a covert operation, right? There's every reason to support this. And no matter what, even if it fails, the longer it lasts and the more the colonies can hold out, the more you can weaken the British Empire. So there's every reason to support it, but not overtly, not openly, because at this point, French officials don't want to enter a war with Great Britain without some sense of confidence that this is a viable insurrection. And for many people think that the result of an alliance with France, of a premature alliance with France, let's call it, would be to actually bring the settlers back into British arms, because, you know, many people might, you know, this might kick in the kind of traditional alliances, right? And people would say, well, actually, you know, we don't want to ally with the French. So you don't want to do this too hastily and push the settlers back into British arms. You want to do it in a way that's going to actually pull them out.
Right. So then France is supplying the United States or the colonies between June of 1775, the first munitions come, and then the Declaration of Independence hits on the 4th of July. Was that formal declaration met by surprise back in Paris, or did they know it was coming? They didn't know quite what form it would take, but they presumed that the next step after war breaks out is some sort of declaration of independent statehood. And then how are Parisians reacting to this?
Well, it gets translated into French quite quickly. And actually, I mean, interestingly, one of the printers who translates it is a colonist, a Caribbean colonist with, you know, a slaveholder. So there's, you know, all kinds of paradoxes that abound. I mean, the declaration, as we all know, doesn't simply, I mean, it does a couple of things, right? I mean, one is that it establishes an independent power, which is what we've been talking about, but that could have been done without all the other rhetoric, right? I mean, it also knits the independence and the establishment of an independent state, which can transact alliances and commercial alliances, political and commercial and military alliances, but it links this to these kind of soaring principles. And this brings us back to this question of the kind of riskiness of this alliance. There are liberals in France who are inspired by this, who think that these principles are something to greatly admire. Some of the physiocrats that we were talking about earlier and others who admire the British political system. Montesquieu was a great admirer of the British political system. They had looked to the colonies. The Quaker, you know, has emerged in France, the figure of the Quaker, as a kind of symbol of the sort of Republican, you know, the simple Republican, the kind of Rousseauian figure who embodies a kind of return to a pure form of politics, a better form of politics, one that isn't corrupted by all the luxury of European aristocracy and wealth and so on. So there are ways in which these principles, they really appeal to liberals in France who have a good deal of influence right now in the 1770s.
And they're just now the French people, they're reading this document in the French newspapers. Is it making a big splash, or is it just sort of something else happening? So yeah. I'm asking about the popular reaction for those literate enough to read newspapers.
It does make a big splash. It does make a big splash. And Franklin, you know, who sent immediately to Paris to try to secure this alliance. Franklin, well, he was already well known in European circles and Enlightenment circles because of his science, because as a scientist. But he capitalizes on this image. I mean, he's a very able diplomat, and he practices what I guess today we would call public diplomacy. He's making sure that these documents are being printed, that the Declaration of Independence is reprinted, that Letters from an American Farmer by John Dickinson, which articulated many of these ideas, is being reprinted in French. And he works closely with printers. Franklin, of course, had been a printer himself. He worked closely with printers in Paris to get these documents republished and to gain support from these kind of liberal circles. And then famously, he goes around Paris dressing down, right? He wears his fur hat. He parades himself as this simple colonist, something which he really wasn't. but he parades, he brings this kind of Quaker ethos, right? So that he can symbolize the kind of Rousseauian figure that people are idealizing. And it's in this moment that Washington, George Washington, becomes this great figure in France as well, which is another U-turn for France, because Washington had been known as the villain who began the Seven Years' War, the assassin who began the Seven Years' War. And now, in a great U-turn, you know, 10 or 12 years later, he's becoming a hero in French circles.
That's interesting. I'm thinking of this period then as there are two great psychological operations going on. The French people need to be convinced that the Americans with whom they were fighting are somehow now cool. And the American British colonists, who'd often are always thought of French as the horrible absolutist dictatorship controlled by the conspiracists in the Vatican, now that the French are actually cool too. This has to happen simultaneously for there to be, victory in the War of Independence.
I think that's right. I mean, I think you're exactly right on that. But it also helps us see the longer threads of the, you know, the sort of ambivalent relationship that France and the United States have had with each other for 250 years now. You know, one in which American admiration of France, which has been around for a very long time, is also intermingled with a kind of condemnation of French values and even contempt, I would say, for a kind of anti-French sentiment. And also in France, is at once an admiration for the United States, but also a suspicion and, you know, a guardedness. And, you know, there's a continued kind of prevalence of anti-American sentiment in France. So the ambivalence of this relationship is foundational. I mean, it begins right. It's right at the beginning.
Right. So in February 1778, the one side wins in the diplomatic halls of Paris. They decide, okay, a formal relationship. We're going to recognize the United States formally, knowing full well that this will lead to a declaration of war against them by Britain. And they're going to have an official treaty. So we kind of know the end of that story. Okay, we're going to come back eventually and end in France and the French Revolution in 1789. But I just want to jump back over the Atlantic one more time and focus on the importance of this idea of France, the French-American relationship, and that critical idea of westward expansion, which is what the original Seven Years' War was about. Who's controlling all of that land in the Ohio Valley and the west towards the Mississippi and then beyond?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of like the geographically decentered nature of this conversation, which is skipping back and forth, because, you know, one thing that I think I've learned from researching the Franco-American relationship, particularly in this period, is that it's not just this kind of bilateral relationship that, you know, links, I don't know, Philadelphia, New York, Washington with Paris or something like that, right? It moves through the Caribbean, as we've talked about. It's very much of a triangular relationship in that regard. The French Caribbean is a very important trading partner, and it circles out west. It circles out through the Ohio Valley, which, as you just said, was the place where the Seven Years' War broke out. More broadly, in the kind of Mississippi Valley in the Trans-Appalachian West, which becomes a source of tension within the British Empire, because the British settlers think that with their victory in the Seven Years' War and the French and Indian War, that Native nations have been defeated and that they now have a right to extend themselves into this area. Native Americans don't see things the same way. Many of them allied with British power, and certainly no Native nations were represented in the treaties that ended the Seven Years' War. And so any cessions are made by France and not by Native Americans. So they don't see things the same way. And the tension between Native American power in the West, it leads to what's called Pontiac's War, and the uprising. And, you know, the British imperial officials want to settle this. Their interest is in maintaining peace and reducing expenses. So it's very hard for the British Empire to balance the interests of these settlers, which are opposed to the interests of their allies in the West.
And didn't Pontiac say something like, well, we didn't lose to the British, the French did. So, like, why are you trying to take our land? We didn't lose this land.
Exactly, exactly. I don't remember
lost,
if that
not
was...
us. I mean, exactly. It could be apocryphal, like the French minister,
no,
but
it's no. I mean, it is a widely quoted line. I don't think it's Pontiac, but it's one of Pontiac's allies. I think it's an Ojibwe who says exactly that. I mean, the French were defeated, but we weren't, which is true, which is absolutely true. You know, when we talk about Canada or New France, there is a demographic dominance of French settlers in the St. Lawrence Valley, which stretches essentially from Quebec to Montreal. But this is a very, and really on one shore of that, but this is a very limited area because Canada extends all the way down the St. Lawrence Valley into the Great Lakes, all of the upper Mississippi region, including, you know, extended the Ohio Valley, all the way up to the Missouri River and all the way down into Louisiana. That's New France as French imperial thing. But who lives in New France? It's not French settlers. It's mostly Native Americans. And, you know, French power, such as it was, existed in alliance, in a set of complex and fascinating alliances with Native American power in the interior. Demographically, French people were a infinitesimal minority. I mean, there were French traders and these famous coureurs de bois, the French traders who would go and marry into Native American villages and nations. And those were the systems of alliances that undergirded French power. So when the French were defeated in the Seven Years' War, you know, one element of this world was gone, but the world remained. I mean, that is to say, a kind of Franco-Métis indigenous mix remained. And these were French-speaking people. And actually, one of the important benefits of the alliance with France for the United States was to resurrect some of the some of these alliances. And one of the things that Americans began trying to do was to, say, we're now allied with the King of France, your traditional ally, your traditional Onontio, it was called, you know, the great mountain, the father figure. And many Native American people want to see France come back into North America. France had committed to the United States that they wouldn't reacquire Canada, reacquire Quebec, but there's a lot of pressure among indigenous allies for France to come back, for the French king to come back to the West. And militarily, these links become very powerful. This heritage, this long, centuries-long Franco-Native American world that had existed in this region becomes critical to the military events in the West. George Rogers Clark, who's one of the generals in the West, doesn't really have any great military victories. I mean, a lot of what he ends up doing is marching into these villages and being greeted as an ally by French and Native American people who were already there and who had this very ambivalent relationship with British military officers. So one of the reasons for American success in the Northwest, in what's in the Ohio country, in what becomes the old Northwest, is precisely because of these longstanding set of alliances with French and Native American people in this region.
Very interesting. Okay, we're coming to the end of our discussion today, Francois, and I want to cross the Atlantic once again, which happened all the time back then. Ships are going back and forth constantly. And I want to go back to this point that we've made several times about some of the contradictions, the ambiguities in the French and American relationship. We all know how the story of how the American Revolution ends, with colonial American patriot plus French victory over Great Britain. But there's this huge contradiction problem that I just want you to talk about to end. We've asked the question, why France would support a movement that we see in the Declaration of Independence is totally against absolute rule. We've talked about the fact that there were French ministers who were a little bit worried about the fact that if there's a precedent set for colonial independence, that could spread to the French colonies as well. At the same time, we saw, of course, that colonists, patriots, are Republican. Why would they want their traditional enemy, France, with all of its papacy and absolute despotic tyranny, which they're trying to escape, why would they seek the support of the absolute king in France? And of course, 13 years after the end of the American Revolution, we have another revolution which shocks Europe, which is the French Revolution. So why don't we just end today? Why don't you just talk about how you see these contradictions, these problems playing out and then appearing in this huge second revolution of the Age of Revolutions, the French Revolution?
Yeah. You know, this is the kind of paradox, one of the central contradictions that's at play here in this age of revolutions. And, you know, one of the interesting things about revolutions is that you never know where they go. I mean, they have very unanticipated effects and outcomes. So when the French crown decided to ally itself with the United States, I mean, it was absolutely central to the American victory. I mean, I think, you know, the victory at Yorktown is as much a French, if not more a French victory than it is an American victory. So there's little doubt, I think, that the United States would not have succeeded in gaining its independence, certainly at least not then, without French support. There's a moment that, you know, in the wake of American independence and of the establishment of American independence, there's a moment, the 1780s is a very interesting period, I think. It's a period of what I think of as economic and political experimentation. So there's an attempt to bring about what had been envisioned in the Franco-American Treaty of Alliance and Commerce to establish greater trading relationships between France and the United States now. And ultimately, they're unsuccessful for a variety of reasons. One is that, you know, France was particularly good at exporting luxuries, which isn't a big market in the colonies at this point. The British economy was just much better at supplying things that the American colonists, now the Americans, wanted and needed, and they did it much more cheaply. So there's a set of, you know, interesting commercial attempts and also interesting ways in which the United States tries to establish stronger links with the French Caribbean. And this begins undermining French interests, right? The merchants in France become concerned about this because they find that they have new competition. So there's all kinds of tensions that emerge here. But ultimately, in much the same way that the British crown in the Seven Years' War had indebted itself, leading to attempts at reforming the British Empire and reforming systems of revenue, which led to the collapse of the British Empire, right? The collapse of the first British Empire. You see a very similar thing happening with France in the 1780s. I mean, the French state, the French crown indebted itself massively in supporting the American insurrection, which was successful, created the United States. But now it created fiscal challenges for the French state. And how are they going to manage those fiscal challenges? And their attempts at reforming the French state and reforming the system of revenues ultimately leads to the French Revolution. So there's the economic connection, which is a important one. And I think without that economic connection, there probably is no French Revolution. But then there's also, as we've been talking about, this ideological connection, right? These ideas that come out of the United States, now, you know, they didn't come out of the United States. I mean, American thinkers borrowed them from France, among other people, right? Borrowed them from European Enlightenment thought. But it brings a great deal of energy to these, you know, Enlightenment currents, these currents that are pushing for a greater liberalization of politics and of the economy. And it brings a great energy to these figures who are becoming important in attempts to reform the French monarchy. The French Revolution doesn't begin as an anti-monarchical effort, no more than the American Revolution began as an anti-monarchical effort, right? I mean, I'm sure you've talked with other guests about how the challenge to the king came late. At first, the colonists are, their grievances are against Parliament. No one's thinking of challenging the British crown. Very similarly, French liberals, nobody's really thinking of challenging. What they want is reforms. But these reforms quickly spin, you know, the revolutionary dynamic becomes impossible to control for the French reformers. And so those who lead the French Revolution in its earliest stages are chased out as the revolution radicalizes. And so those who supported, I mean, there's all kinds of paradoxes and ironies, right? Those who supported the American Revolution, people like Lafayette, who supported the American Revolution from the very beginning and who support the French Revolution from the very beginning, find themselves chased out, and Lafayette flees to Austria and ends up in an Austrian prison. So these events spin out of control. The French crown, which supported the American rebellion, ultimately against a king, the king ultimately, you know, the Louis the 16th finds himself on the losing end of another Republican revolution, which takes place. And by the way, when the Americans, in the way that Americans do, when they see the French Revolution break out, French Revolution, which has all kinds of causes, one of which is tied to the United States, but certainly not the most important, they see this as a legacy of their own revolution, right? So for them, this is what the American Revolution did. And, you know, the American Revolution is it's important 250 years later. We can see that because the United States became a great power. But at the time, this was a pretty marginal place. I mean, it wasn't clear that this was going to become. It could have gone in all kinds of ways, right? The colonies could have split up. I mean, it didn't need to leave a legacy. It wasn't inevitable that it would leave a legacy any greater than, let's say, Corsican independence a decade earlier. But the French Revolution, now that is uncontestably a major event. No one can doubt the central importance of the French Revolution to European and to world affairs. So insofar as the American Revolution did inspire the French Revolution, that was its greatest legacy in the 18th century. And it's only later that the American Revolution becomes an important event in and of itself for establishing the United States.
Retroactively, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Francois, we're coming to the end. I asked all my guests to conclude just with their one major takeaway as they think about the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So if there's one important thing you think we should all remember about the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, what would that be?
Well, I don't know if this is the biggest thing, but I think it's a useful reminder. One of the aspects that our conversation has brought out today, I think, is the way in which there isn't an American perspective or there isn't a French perspective, right? There were clashing interests and clashing visions and clashing ideologies on both sides of the Atlantic, in the United States and in France. And, you know, Americans argued with themselves about the Declaration of Independence. They argued about whether this was the right move. There's about whether it should happen at all, and if it should happen, when. And Americans have been arguing with each other for 250 years now, and those arguments ultimately are disruptive and they're uncomfortable. But they I think ultimately in the long term they're possibly a source of strength. So I think it's worth not fetishizing a kind of imagined unity that might have existed in 1776 that we've fallen away from, and keeping in mind that there have always been bitter divisions and always been clashing visions and ideas and interests, and that continues today.
All right, Professor Francois Furstenberg, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.